and welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. This week we are talking about a Brian pick, and let's take a I'm taking a pause here, because we've been here before. We've been in the situation where it looks like Brian is finally making intelligent picks for us. So I don't want to applaud him too soon, but I will say that only one of his like next four picks I'm kind of not looking forward to. So, Brian, thank you for kicking off 2021 with something that is, A, very true to who you are as a person, but B, is actually something that we could have like a semi-decent conversation about, which is 1976, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. So why don't you tell us why you picked this movie?
So this movie is, I'm surprised it took me this long to pick it. I think it's just getting used to the show. Like, I would just kind of think of like ridiculous movies and
it
not
took
so much.
2 years, but here we are.
Honestly, all of my picks, my next few upcoming picks, I was actually genuinely shocked that they weren't done before my time. Because you guys got a long catalog. It's tough for me to go back and
Why
look
do you
through
keep
everything.
Saying you guys?
Yeah,
you
you're too. Part of this now. You're part of
yeah,
it now.
Yeah, but your original catalog I wasn't a part of. And it's a lot to go through in my mind. So I never really do.
I made you a list.
I know you did. it's reading. I have to sound out every word. It's difficult. But anyway, so Town That Dreaded Sundown is one of my favorite horror movies. And I do want to get this out of the way. I understand this movie is very, very inappropriate. And not in like, it's not problematic in the way that you think. It's more problematic because it's a true crime story that really hyper-focuses on the murders and the victims. And then like they try to do like some like humor, like add some like humor for effect. And it's like, you know, these are people's lives. Because like there's some stuff that was edited for Hollywood, but for the most part, like the murders, they're real, you know, like people are murdered.
People actually died for this movie?
yeah.
But there's just something so charming about it. I mean, I fell in love as soon as, I don't know if you guys ever saw St. Valentine's Day Massacre. It's like a old mafia movie, but it's the same thing. Like, I just love that like documentary narration.
That
I don't know what it is.
My first note is I love old 70s narration, like old 70s film narration. Now, the big difference is that, like, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was smart in just having it up in the front and then nowhere else in the movie. I don't think I need it, like, the daily updates from the narrator throughout the film. But I do enjoy, like you said, like, the true crime aspect, that it does feel like you're watching a documentary or that you're watching this recreation. But I also agree with you that, like, the humor beats are all weird. Like, they don't really have any place in the movie, and I can never tell if it's padding time or if it's just trying to, like, lighten the darkness of the film. I don't know. This movie is, it's a very strange movie. And I know that you actually love both versions of Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, even you were, like, kind of, hey, the remake is actually too good of a movie, whereas this has like some issues.
yeah. Like, there's a lot that you can bust on in this. You know what I mean? This is like, if you notice, I say this is one of my favorite horror movies. I don't say it's one of the best. Yeah. Like, I'm well aware.
Yeah, those things don't have to be the same. There's a Venn diagram, guys. Good movies and movies we love.
Yeah.
And the hardest thing is for us to pinpoint where in the center of that diagram we can sit with the show.
It's just so funny because this movie does so many things right and so many things wrong simultaneously that it's almost impressive.
I think that's just pure adrenaline.
Yeah, like I've said before, like I think that the reveal of the Phantom Killer when he slams down that car hood and it's a quick zoom in on his eyes through that burlap sack mask, like that is great. That is like great filmmaking. It's well shot. It's like intense. It kind of burns into your memory. Like, I know that that's good filmmaking because I remember it so much more vividly in my head than what it actually is when I rewatch the movie. Like, it's just a well done scene. But then, like, 10 minutes later, you have like the deputy standing in the rain doing the most over the top dramatic head shake as the Phantom Killer evades him, that you're just like, well, what the shit was that? For everything that works, there's two things that don't.
Yeah, and like the fucking scene where the deputy has to dress up as a woman and then he's getting felt up by the other guy in the car. That whole scene really doesn't work for me.
That's probably the biggest scene to go back to what Brian said, where I'm watching that and it's like, you know, actual people die.
Yeah.
You're showing us this wacky, like, what would be a scene out of Porky's in the middle of this movie right before we tell the actual story of how a 15-year-old girl was murdered. Like, this is so uneven in the way that it tells this stuff.
It's the same reason that, like, Wolves at the Door, I feel like, didn't work as a movie, especially when you're dealing with, like, you're making a movie about the Manson family, right? And the movie starts and the whole focus is Sharon Tate's house. Like, to me, that's bad taste, as opposed to, like, if that was a scene in the movie and the movie was focused on the Manson family, or like Zodiac, where it's like focused on this guy trying to find the Zodiac, like, don't make the victims the fucking center point of a true story. You know what I mean?
I don't know what the deal is. They always call them the Keystone Cops, but I don't know why that was such a big thing in the 70s. There's so many, like, even something as, like, uncomfortable to watch as, like, Last House on the Left has these weird comedy scenes with the cops. Like, I don't know why, like, the 70s were like, we gotta make the jokes.
I blame fucking Andy Griffith.
Yeah.
Andy Griffith show, man.
That's actually a really good fucking take.
Really?
Yeah. It makes sense. Well, golly. Still, like, talking about, like, how it does something so good and then follows it up with something so absurd is, like, the scene that I just referenced after the... You go from... Like what Scott said, the deputy's in drag, getting felt up, and that's awkward and not very well done. Then you have this incredible, I would say one of the most incredible, like, stunt scenes where you've got a dude just dangling off of a car door trying to throw someone out of the car. And it's like, man, this movie was made for fucking nothing. So this is a impressive...
Yeah. Yeah, that wasn't a real stuntman. That was just a dude that was like, okay, I guess I'm going to hold on for dear life.
So it kind of was. And the only reason I say that is because I was doing, as I was like looking up information on the people that were in this movie, the actor who played the Phantom Killer is a stuntman. Like, he still continues to do stunt work to this day. So, like, that was a good casting choice to just be like, hey, we never need to see this guy's face. We never need to hear him talk. Let's just get a stunt actor so we can have him do some crazy ass shit throughout the movie. But you have... that incredible scene, but then you followed up with the trombone kill, which, like, we can digest the trombone kill for like 10 minutes, but the biggest insult about the trombone kill, and I didn't get a ton of information, but I did read that one of the victims' families sued the movie because of how it was presented as what really happened. And I was like, the trombone kill is so absurd that there has to be some, like, lingering element of something to explain it. So I Googled about this particular woman and her death. Here's where I got almost offended. She was a saxophone player. And there was a big deal that they couldn't find the saxophone for months after her death. Like, they found it like 6 or 7 months later, hidden in the bushes. But that's like, the director was just like, saxophone, huh? What other band instruments could I use to murder somebody with? And it's like, that is so, like, for a movie that sticks pretty tight to, like, timelines and situations, to suddenly just be like, yeah, but I really want to see someone tie a knife to the end of a trombone and just stab someone a bunch of times with it is just
insane. I thought
that
scene was so absurd the first time, and I was like, well... it had to be real. Like, I was like, that had to be what the guy did. Because I thought that it was stupid the first time. And the second time watching it, I was like, you know, I could see someone who's, like, really sadistic being like, this would be funny to them. I don't think of it as a funny scene. I think of it as, like, a really sadistic scene.
Yeah.
Because it's almost humiliating in that way. And that's what the Phantom Killer is. He's completely brutal, completely sadistic. He has no motive. It's just literally killing when he gets the chance. He's just out prowling.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the other thing. The flip side of that is, like, I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, but I found myself on a pretty deep dive into, like, the whole murder case after watching this, just to try to, like, piece together the movie versus the reality a little bit.
And I did, like, a few years ago, but it's, if I know that they think that they caught the guy, which was, they made reference to in the movie. That's like their prime suspect, but I don't remember a lot of it.
Yeah, the guy's never been caught. But they were saying that, like, whoever this guy was, it was both spur of the moment, but also very meticulously planned out. Like, like he always knew where to go based on where the cops were currently hiding out, essentially. Yeah. Like, he always knew the right spots to be and, like, where to go. And then, like, he kind of disappeared because someone had escaped that he was afraid, like, he left too much evidence and then he just stopped doing it. Or, as they said in the end, some people believe he just got caught for a whole different crime and made sure to keep his mouth shut. Because I read about that guy. There's even a couple books that all say that they are almost positive it was him. But he was, like, he got pulled over for stealing a car. And he asked how many, if he would get the electric chair. And they're like, we don't give the electric chair for stealing cars. And he's like, I don't think you realize what else you've got me for. And that was all he said. And then shortly thereafter, people stopped getting murdered in Texas and Arkansas. So they think that that may have been like a subtle admission of guilt. But the kills in this movie, it's so weird because like the special effects aren't there. You know what I mean? Like it's a low budget movie. You really don't get a whole lot. But like, some of the squib work is insane.
Well, the kill we haven't got to my like to me is the best scene in the movie, and the, and as much as like the opening shot of him slamming the hood is fucking awesome, him barging into the fucking screen door, like that whole scene is my favorite.
Yeah,
scene in the
that
movie.
That squib shot at the wife when she's by is insane. Yeah. How good that looks.
Yeah,
completely intense, and that scene is very and that's what makes the like comedic beats so stressful is like, I get that you've got these intense scenes and you kind of want to like lighten the mood a little bit, but there's definitely better routes than like drag and slapstick.
Yeah, it's like they were thinking, oh man, we gotta lighten this up because it's super dark, let's go super light. They so the pendulum swang so far to the other side that it's just it almost makes a mockery of the negativity in the movie. It's a dark ass movie though. It's, like it's not a movie that I would pick of my own volition ever again. I mean, seeing it twice is enough. I think it's important.
Now, my flip side is, and I texted Brian about this when I was watching it last night, and I think it's because of the narration, but like this is a movie that if I found out that like the local drive-in was doing this and another feature, I would be interested in seeing it in a drive-in setting. I feel like it would even amplify the intensity in a drive-through like set, a drive-in like setting.
Yeah, because like, they get killed in cars. I mean,
so that's I think that's the most likely time that I will rewatch this is when it inevitably plays at a drive-in.
Guys, I got an idea. Okay, do any of us live in a state where you aren't allowed to conceal carry?
I'm about to live in one where it's a little bit more complicated.
Okay, well, then what they should do is they should have it at a drive-in in your state and fucking have somebody dress up as a phantom killer and just, like, walk around scratching on doors and shit.
My dad told me a story one time, and I never know the validity of this story, but I want to believe that it's true, that he went to see the original Night of the Living Dead at a drive-in, and the place that it was, the screen was, like, up in the woods, essentially, and then, like, where all the cars were, it was, like, cleared out, and that the drive-in had hired people to slowly emerge from the woods.
Oh, God.
During the movie and walk past all the cars. I don't know how true that is, but I would love to do that.
I would have more comfort doing that. Because you have to be like, oh, let me get my gun. Zombies are here. As opposed to like, I've seen enough horror movies where it's not out of the realm of possibility that a copycat killer dresses up and kills people at the showing of the movie.
I mean, we've learned that it could be a child and he just frames his twin brother for doing it. Like,
yeah.
You see that?
Yeah, man. But the bigger thing I think is twofold. One is the fact that even if there were zombies, people would just jump, you know, they'd be roided out dudes and drunk rednecks that would be like, finally get to have my murder boner satisfied, you know? Like, but also, here's the thing that is confusing to me or just, you know, kind of twists my brain a little bit. You know, you work in a haunt. There are people that we know that we've met through conventions that work at haunts. We know people that work, that own haunts. Do you pat people down for guns? Because, like, take one drunk redneck or one asshole that's, like, trigger happy and they're going to shoot a fucking actor.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been patted down, but also they probably just look at me and are like, Yeah, no, he's cool.
Who, Shy Ronnie? Yeah, he's fine. Let him in.
I want to talk about, because the movie has a couple fabricated scenes, but the last scene is so fully fabricated.
The swamp?
Just the whole idea that he's just walking around in daylight with a fucking burlap
mask on.
Well, let's be fair here. He was walking around in daylight and they just color coded it so it looked like it was winter or nighttime in the rain scene earlier on.
Yeah, but I'm talking about like the chase scene where they're just like, huh, I see this car. Here's the footprints. There he is just wandering around in a mask. And then there's like the whole chase scene. He jumps behind the train. And then Brian, just the quickest eye in the game.
Dude, it wasn't that quick. It was like 3 seconds long. And I was like, holy shit. And then I had to, just to interject with Matt. If you watch this movie towards the end, when the train is separating them and he's running away, you will see a shirtless Matthew McConaughey in Dazed and Confused holding a camera on the train. So
when you sent us that screenshot, I was like, no. And then I watched the movie that night and I was like, yep, saw him.
But I will say something in defense of them about that fabrication at the end is there's really no way to end it.
Yeah, so you kind of have to make something up.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have to add something as opposed to like, then he almost killed this woman and didn't. Goodbye.
Oh, you mean the Brian Kelly way of ending movies?
And that's the end of the movie.
That's if I ever write a movie, that's what the last person on camera is going to say.
It's going to be like a super serious doc, and then you're just going to be like, and that's the end of the movie. Yeah.
But no, good pick. I mean, it was fun to revisit. It's a quick watch. It's like an hour and 88 minutes. Jesus, I did that math wrong. It's about 88 minutes long. If you could drop the hour in my previous sentence. But yeah, it's fine. It's very of its time.
I wish I
love. I know. Yes, you do. It's keeping you wide awake.
I also love naps, apparently. I got one thing to say about this movie and about our podcast in a more specific manner. But the voiceover says, a terror so indelibly printed. And people say we're not a cultured podcast. Yo, fuck you.
Yeah, how dare they? So the guy who did this, Charles P. Pierce, did a couple.
That's a serial killer name if they're.
Oh, you're going to take my double feature.
Oh, never mind. Then we won't say anything. Yeah. But I was going
to
say.
Brian gets to do his double feature first.
He gets to do his double feature
dumb
first.
Dumb shit.
I was just saying that his career has had some ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
The Blu-ray actually comes with another one of his movies. But it's the movie he's most famous for, which is weird. Brian, how about you go first with your double feature before I say what his other big movie was?
So his double feature I've actually never seen, but I've been meaning to see it. I would have to pick it for the show, and I would never do that because I've heard enough about it. But I would double feature this with The Legend of Boggy Creek,
yep.
1972. Fake documentary about Bigfoot.
I feel like in 2021 or 2022, we are at a point in our show where we're not actually going to be losing any listeners if you pick something that absurd. So, you know, go all nuts, right, my friend.
I'll tell you what, I'll do what Scott does because Scott cares about us more than I care about us. I will watch this movie first.
All right, so
and then make a decision.
I just want to throw in some fun facts here. So he made The Legend of Boggy Creek in 1972, and it's actually a pretty cool-looking poster. It's just sundown, and it's some type of Bigfoot creature running through the water. But in 1985, when I was born, he made Boggy Creek 2, The Legend Continues.
Oh, no. Brian, that's what you need to watch and tell
us. Poster, and the poster for that one is a sun setting over the mountains, and it looks like Bigfoot is running with a child Bigfoot in tow.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Guys.
But then there was this fun fact. It says, despite the title, the film is actually the third in the film franchise following 1977's Return to Boggy Creek. But apparently that was directed by somebody else, and he was just like, fuck you, I'm the creator of Boggy Creek, so I'm going to decide when part two is. Also, just throwing that out there, in his random movies, in between Boggy Creek but before Town That Dreaded Sundown, he was the set decorator for Black Belt Jones. So,
dude, I got to watch the sequel now.
Yeah. do just bounce around in careers. But the Scream Factory Blu-ray of A Town That Dreaded Sundown came with a movie called The Evacuators, which was his crime horror film starring Vic Morrow and Jessica Harper. It doesn't look that good or interesting.
But it's Jessica Harper, so I know that you're happy.
Yes, no, I'm glad that I have that on Blu-ray because I bought this on Blu-ray. But I know that I probably watched it, but I don't remember a damn thing about it.
I'm doing Friday the 13th Part 2 just because it's another baghead killer.
Okay, fair enough. Nice. And I was going with the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre because it has that sweet narration in the front, and they are both very low-budget movies.
Well, I picked Boggy Creek for that reason because I knew that that would be yours. I didn't want to take it from you.
You could also do TCM 2. I mean, I would never turn down TCM 2. So, you know, if you wanted to be like, let's watch Town of Dreaded Sundown, both versions, and then we watch TCM 1 and TCM 2, make a whole fucking day
of
it.
That's a fucking day. I love it. So, Brian, is there anything that you watched or listened to or whatever that you want to say, yo, this was pretty good?
Yeah, man. I watched for the first time. It's like a 10-year-old movie, but I finally watched True Grit. I was just in like a cowboy type mood. I personally enjoyed it. I don't know who I knew saw it. Maybe it was you. Someone was not too big on it.
I liked it. It's not one I'd ever revisit because I'm not a Western guy, but mm-hmm. like I'll watch anything the Coen brothers make just out of curiosity.
And I think that's the thing where people don't like it that much because it's definitely far from one of the best Coen brothers movie. But if someone else made it, I'm like, wow, this is a really good movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't like have the feel of a Coen brothers movie.
No, it's not like whimsical enough. Like I feel like their movies, no matter how serious they get, there's always at least a little element of whimsy. And this one doesn't have that. Scott, how about you? What did you watch or listen to or whatever read that you're like, yo, check this ish out?
Ugh, shit. Am I actually supposed to say that I want to watch this or that you should watch this?
I mean, you could.
I'll give you the shit sandwich. Well, not the shit sandwich, but I'll give you a shit open face sandwich where the shit is on the sandwich, but the sandwich bread is good. How's that? Literally, I'm going to tell you something that we watched that was fucking awful and then something that we are currently watching that is delightful. And I want to talk about the fact that the Venn diagram of my Netflix desires are hilarious. So, first of all, I wanted to watch the new Star Wars movies. I was like, let's watch 7, 8, and 9. And Megan was like, sure, if you promise that we start from the very beginning with episode 1. And I was like,
ooh.
And I was like, you know what? I love Star Wars, and I love my wife. Let's do it. And Phantom Menace is some of the worst shit I've ever seen. I remember how much I hated it back then, but it is so much worse now. It is so bad. And my buddy Johnny will defend that shit till the day he dies, and it disgustingly bad. Okay, so this is the most shocking thing about The Phantom Menace to me, is it's very obviously a child's movie. It's a movie for mm-hmm. fucking children, and the only adults that like it were children when they watched it. That's just the nostalgia factor. See, there we go. I knew that Brian would be the perfect poster child for this. Also, probably what led him down the path of a life of drugs and crime. The thing is that for a movie that's supposed to be for kids, because you have characters that are literally slapstick characters, like we got Jar Jar Binks, who's a racist Jamaican character. We have fish people that are racist Asian people. We have, you know, like every alien is fucking a racist caricature. But also, this movie is so boring. For a kid's movie, there's like literally no action. Action scenes are super short, and it's about them like overthrowing the government.
Well, that's,
and the kids don't give a fuck about that.
That's the biggest problem with the prequels. And I mean, we've already done plenty of Star Wars talk early in 2021, so we'll try to keep this to a minimum.
Oh, this is the last thing I'll say about it.
But the movie, like, with George Lucas in those movies, it was like he was both trying to make a kids movie, which is one very specific genre of film, but he was also trying to make a like scathing critique of the government at that time, which is a totally different movie that you probably shouldn't try to also incorporate into your kids movie. Like, it just creates such a boring, uneven combination in doing so.
Yeah, the movie is so fucking boring, and we're not even done with it. We're like, I think we have 45 more minutes, and I'm just dead. It's so bad. But anyway, so we tried to watch that. I think that we were punishing ourselves with that on like Christmas night or something. Oh, no, we watched Wonder Woman 84 on Christmas night, which is the other thing I wanted to talk about. Absolutely loved it. It was a great time. I made a post on my personal Facebook about how much I enjoyed it. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but I think that the criticisms I'm seeing from people on the internet are really brutal. I don't know why, because it's... Here's the thing. I just wish people gave half as much of a shit about real-life important things like politics and wearing a fucking mask and, you know, like... being good people, and instead of being a shitbag about a superhero movie on the internet.
Yeah, I don't get it. I didn't like it very much, but it didn't affect my mood, for starters. And secondly, like, my opinion on that movie would be the equivalent to my mom's opinion on a horror movie. Like, I don't really like I don't have a love for comics or superhero movies, so I'm not really one to have an opinion on the matter. I just, anything that's 2.5 hours, I'm going in with my hands on my hips.
And here's the thing is that we watched that over the course of 2 nights, or we watched it on Christmas night and then we finished it on the day of the 26th. And that made it a much easier watch because I am not sitting through a 2.5 hour movie ever again if I have to, unless I have to.
And the only things that didn't like work for me were like, I just didn't like the one thing where I was just like, man, I'm not liking this movie too much is the mall scene with the little girl. And just like the head, there was just an interaction where I'm like, I don't like this movie too much. But like, it wasn't bad. I've seen way worse superhero movies. I watched the original Incredible Hulks when I was a child.
Oh, yeah. Dude, I saw those in theaters.
You know?
Well, no, like the Hulk. Yeah. That one is so bad. But actually, the Edward Norton one's not that bad.
Oh, I'm talking like the made-for-TV ones. But I did also see the Hulk in theaters. And I perfectly timed a sonic boom fart at the quietest part of the movie and made the entire theater laugh. Yeah. And even then, I knew the signs to it. Like, I put my feet on the back of the chair in front of me.
Listen, I think that 12-year-old boys know the science of farts more than anyone else in the world. It's innate.
Shit. All right. So for my what should you watch this week? This isn't like a hard recommend, but it was an all right way to kill 90 minutes. There was a movie on Hulu that a friend told me to check out called Plus One, and it is a pseudo rom-com. It's not breaking any new ground. It's the typical rom-com.
Who's the woman in it?
It's Maya from Pen 15 the main guy from The Boys.
You mean Huey?
Yeah, it's two friends and all their friends are getting married and they're the only two single friends, so they always take each other to weddings as dates and then slowly fall in love, and that's the movie. But it's fine. It's charming. It's whatever. But the big recommend, the big thing, is that Chris Ophias of One Hit Thunder sends me a link the other day and says, yo, we need to try to get the host of this podcast on our podcast. And it's a podcast called Bizarre Albums. And it's hosted by Tony Thaxton of Motion City Soundtrack. And every episode is 18 to 20 minutes long. And he just does a deep dive into the history of one weird novelty album. So it'll be like the WWF wrestling album where Simpsons sing the blues. But the link that he sent me was for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of Their Shells. And it's just a 20-minute breakdown of like what studio musicians were used for the recording of that, like how they promoted the album, who created the album, why they created the album. Sometimes there's like brief little interview clips that he'll do with the people who worked on the production, but he keeps it down to a tight 20 minutes. And that thing is fantastic. For Wonder Woman 84, he just released an episode on Linda Carter's Lone album that she put out in the 70s.
Oh my God.
So like, it's just always, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. So I definitely recommend it because they are just fun little bite-size podcast content. So Bizarre Albums is
I'll check
what
it
you
out.
Search.
I own Simpsons Sing the Blues.
I do too.
No, I owned it at one point and then you took it from me. But that's neither here nor there. Owning the grudges.
So one thing I want to ask you, Matt, is did you watch Holidate?
I did. It was good. The thing with Holidate is like, because we were talking about that, I was talking about this with someone else, and I was like, it's like kind of a Christmas rom-com, but it also covers every other holiday because it takes a whole year.
Yeah, it covers every holiday.
Yeah, so it's like, it's I don't know if I would consider, like, I don't know if it would become like a yearly Christmas watch as much as it would just be like a, hey, I need a rom-com to put on in the background. But it was fun. It was a lot more filthier than I expected it to be. I didn't realize it was an R. When I put it on, I was like, oh, there's a lot of graphic talk about sex in this movie.
They want me to put my what in what?
All right. Well, that was Town That Dreaded Sundown. Tune in next week when we talk about a demon that takes over your nightmares.
Wind.
But
no, that was when you were watching The Hulk in theaters.
But it's maybe not the demon that takes over your nightmares that you're thinking it is. So stay tuned for that, and we will be back next week with another episode of Horror Movie Night.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.